Welcome to Comics,
episode 249. This week, we talk about
Thunderbolts, Faith in Monsters.
Visit us at welcometocomics.com. Listen to past episodes, see what we're reading next, send us a message, or find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr. This episode is supported by listeners like you. Go to patreon.com/welcometocomics.
And now, the cast.
That's fine. So I'm going to give you guys a little bit of Woody Panther. I finally got back to watching Daredevil because my wife gave me the okay to watch it without her. And I got to episode 8, which is Wilson Fisk's background, right? Mm-hmm. And I cringed because I felt like I felt like a terrible person for watching it. When Wilson Fisk confronts his father about how his father beats his mother, and the hammer and the keep kicking him, it made me feel so dirty. Like, it made my soul, like, wretch, and I had to turn it off. Which sucks, because I really, really like the show. I really like the
character development. That was a pretty intense part.
I really like the character development. I really like the painting and Vanessa and Wilson Fisk's, and setting Wilson up as a dichotomy with the same goals, but opposite end of the spectrum as Matt. Like, I love so much about this show, but when it gets graphic, it gets too graphic for me, and I just can't.
I skipped past the hammer scene because I was like, okay, I can't do any more of this. Yeah, this is a lot of hammer.
I just can't. And it makes me think, like, they can go there because it's on Netflix, but maybe they shouldn't go there just because it's on Netflix. Like, congratulations, you got on a quote unquote network or they'll let you get away with this stuff, but you don't need to do this. So I'm just going to skip straight to Jessica Jones.
Jessica Jones definitely has a lot less of that. It does that more emotionally. Like, there are scenes that are emotionally very grating to watch, but oh my god.
Oh, I can handle that. I'm stone cold.
The hammer scene and the car door scene, I had to, like, cover my ears and eyes.
Yeah. The car door scene is what made my wife was back in for a couple episodes, and then we got to the car door, and she was like, nope, I'm done. Bye.
Well, I mean, the thing is, though...
Okay, wait. Go ahead and finish this conversation without me. It's fine. I will hear it when I edit this show. But I gotta get back to the baby girl. It was nice talking to you guys for a little bit.
So, David, you were saying something about Daredevil and the violence?
Well, I was gonna say, like, now that he's gone, I don't want to have the argument with no one. I mean, so yeah, the part with the hammer and the car door are definitely graphic and violent. I'm not going to argue that they're not. The thing is, though, I think that a lot of TV shows do things that make people uncomfortable. And I feel like maybe this just varies person to person. Well, not maybe. I think it certainly does. But, you know, there are some things that people can't watch. Like, the scene in Battlestar Galactica, where what's her name? I don't remember. It's been so long since I watched that show. The blonde Cylon. Do you remember what number she is, Jen?
No, or Brandon? I don't.
Well, the part where she's on Galactica in the brig and she's gonna be basically raped, right? That part made me extremely uncomfortable. Like, I had a lot of trouble watching that part of the show. So I'm not really sure what I kind of lost what my point was, but I think, you know, for me, the Daredevil scene with the hammer and stuff is definitely violent, and pretty graphic. But, you know, maybe Andy is right. They don't need to go that level. You can kind of, there's plenty of ways to show that kind of thing is going to happen without actually showing it. But I think the point I was wanted to make to Andy is that's probably the pinnacle of graphic violence in the Daredevil show. So I think it's you know, yeah, if you can stand to continue and see what else comes afterwards, I wouldn't give up on the show just yet, because the quality of the storytelling does not change. It continues to be really, you know, really high quality. And then skipping to Jessica Jones, you know, like Jen said, there are a lot of very uncomfortable moments in that show too. They're just not uncomfortable in the same way that that those scenes in Daredevil. So, you know.
Yeah, it also, I mean, the Hammer scene does also kind of show the intensity of Wilson Fisk. Like, you know, he's like a pretty intense guy. You just don't realize exactly to what extent he is.
Yeah.
Because he's a pretty passionate dude. He just doesn't show it. And, you know, especially as a child, you don't have the same kind of emotional restraint that you do when you're an adult. So that is definitely a showing of exactly what he's capable of and exactly how far he will go.
Well, I think what that scene shows about Wilson is that he was definitely, kind of coddled by his mother. And then, he kept his rage inside in him for a long time because he didn't, his father was such a domineering person. And, I think all that pent-up emotion came out in that scene where he killed his father, you know?
It's definitely not pointless, like, carnal brutality. It's not there just to shock you. It is a really good contrast to, like, how calm and controlled and mannered and sophisticated he is throughout the rest of the show. And I think it's supposed to really just make him that much scarier as a villain, because,
he's...
He's so calm and, like, high class, and then suddenly he's beating people to death with car doors and hammers, and you're like, wow, this guy has a really hidden dark side.
Yeah, because the vast majority of the time where we see Wilson, he doesn't act like that. He is calm and collected, and we get these small glimpses of what really lies beneath. Because even when he's calm and collected, he's still pretty scary, but not in a physical way until we see these scenes, you know?
Yeah, and, I mean, because I remember him as Kingpin from Spider-Man the Animated Series.
Yeah.
And I was kind of like, this guy is totally lame. I don't understand why there's a big fat guy, and everybody's scared of him. And then, later on, reading him in comics and watching him on the Daredevil, like, that portrayal, it was like, okay, so I totally get this now. This is terrifying.
You know, it's funny, even though, like, Wilson, or Vincent D'Onofrio's portrayal of Wilson Fisk is excellent. Whenever I read him in the comics, his voice is still the voice from the animated series.
Yeah, actually, that's exactly what I hear. Especially during, there's like scenes, I can't remember which series it was, but he's in prison, and all I can hear is the animated voice, and I'm like, okay, I can be cool with this.
So speaking of voices, that strange voice you hear, listeners, is my cousin Brandon. He is a big fan of the Thunderbolts, so we asked him which ones we should read for the show, and then because he gave his 2 cents, we decided to suck more out of him and make him appear on the show. Well, not really appear, since this is an audio-only format, but you're going to hear his voice for the rest of this episode, because Andy is still on paternity leave, and his baby has something against podcasts. So welcome, Brandon.
Thank you.
Welcome.
This week's comic.
So for this episode, we decided to read Thunderbolts Classic, Volume 1, with Kurt Busiek. It's written by Kurt Busiek, and most of the art is done by Peter David. This trade that we read was kind of interesting because it collects issues 1 through 5 from the 1997. I guess this is Volume 1, huh? This is the very first Thunderbolts title. It also includes the Thunderbolts Annual Number 1, Tales from the Marvel Universe, I forget which number, and like Marvel Team-Up or Spider-Man Team-Up or something like that. So it wasn't just the Thunderbolts title, but the extra non-Thunderbolt titles do connect to the story, at least tangentially, or they're made reference to in the main title. It was longer than I thought it was going to be. I was not able to find it on Marvel Digital Cinematic, Marvel whatever universe thing. You know, the digital subscription thing. So I ended up buying the Kindle version, which is pretty good. I kind of like reading the Kindle version of the comics. It's gotten better over the years. It's almost on par with the Dark Horse app, which I think still is the gold standard for digital comics. But yeah, this was a good one. So Brandon, since you wanted us to read Thunderbolts, you made this listener request when you were a listener. Tell us a little bit about why you like Thunderbolts so much and why you wanted us to read this comic in particular.
Well, so the Thunderbolts was one of the recommended ones, I think, that you recommended when we really got back into comics, which was, what, like 2006, 2007?
It was around the time. It was probably like
Secret Invasion, I want to say.
I think it was right at the tail end of Civil War, right before Secret Invasion started.
Yeah, that was it. And I remember I was talking to you about it, and I was like, okay, so, like, you really loved the Avengers, you liked, you know, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., all that kind of stuff, and I wasn't really finding a team, like, I identified with. Mostly because my comic reading was so sporadic, like, I just kind of read anything. It didn't really matter what it was. I remember I was getting paid way too much at a job, and my comic list, I think, per week was, like, almost $120, which is, you know, that's a very large list. And I remember at one point you were kind of like, you should check these guys out, because they're just bad guys playing heroes.
I think I had come across them. They had appeared in another title.
Yeah, there was a tie-in, and then I think from there I immediately was like, just, I was so caught up with the lore and the history of, like, because the Thunderbolts are never really the same all the time. There's so many different leaders, and there's so many different change-ups, and I think I really dove into it definitely with Civil War, and then I kind of crawled backwards and started from the beginning.
And yeah, I think it had
an interesting start to it, especially since the reveal of who the Thunderbolts were was kind of like mind-blowing.
Yeah, I've never actually read that. I've never really... This is actually the first one I've read where Citizen V is the leader of the team, because I started reading around the time that we mentioned earlier. I think I started picking up the comic, or I added it to my list when there were the Secret Invasion tie-ins, and I kept collecting it until the team changed to be Thunderbolt Ross's team, where it's the team of guys with red costumes.
Oh, yeah, because he's the Red Hulk, and they had this whole red theme.
Yeah, even Punisher, when Punisher's skull...
He had the red skull on his shirt, which was really dumb. It was really dumb.
I gave that run a try, but it just wasn't the same as, you know, what it had been before. And that's fine, you know, comics change, and that's okay.
But yeah, that definitely was not the best version of the Thunderbolts. I'm definitely a huge fan of the Luke Cage era.
Yeah, me too.
Especially with the A team and the B team, and it just kind of goes crazy from there. But yeah, I mean, there's something about the Thunderbolts, especially, like, I collect all the Heroclix. For anything that says Thunderbolts and has Heroclix, I immediately need to collect that one. Yeah. I've gotten rid of a bunch of long boxes of comics, but the Thunderbolts issues are always the ones I keep. I have every trade. I mean, I've got random backgrounds on my computer that kind of show up, and it's just a team that I've definitely always stuck with and stayed faithful to, just because they always try something new and they always do something different. And especially since there's a new Thunderbolts lineup coming out, and they did something really cool with it, because the 1997 cover has Citizen V, and it has, like, the whole, like, dynamic from left to right, and the new leader is now the Winter Soldier, and they mocked up the old issue pose, but with the new lineup.
Yeah, that's very cool. I've seen some of the promotional stuff for that. Well, yeah, thanks, so... Brandon. So let me ask you this, Jen. I've read a bunch of Thunderbolts. Not this lineup, but, you know, I kind of have an idea of what the team is about. Jen, have you read any of Thunderbolts before?
No, I came into this completely fresh. No idea about it. It was interesting. I mean, I gotta say, like, at first I was kind of thrown off by the 90s-ness of it.
Yeah, it's very 90s for sure. It's
super 90s. And mostly, like, I don't know, I actually struggled a lot with the reading because it was so text-heavy and the prose was so florid. It had, like, I started counting the adverbs, and there's, like, there are more adverbs, like, per sentence than necessary in every sentence. It's just, yeah, it verged on purple at times, like, that writing. But I got to the part where they were like, but really, we're supervillains, and I was just like, what? I thought that was a really good reveal. Now, I'm interested to see if, you know, we see the hints, like, of, I think, Meteorite and one other person feeling like they want to be heroes, and then Jolt coming in thinking she's legitimately a hero working with these guys. So I'd like to see that develop, but the idea that Baron Zemo has that they'll just take over the world once everyone trusts them seems so Silver Age plot goofy. So I don't know where that's going.
So Baron Zemo, I always, David likes to tease me when we play HeroClix and I pick Baron Zemo. But Baron Zemo is uncomfortably wordy. He is very long-winded. Every time he's written in, he has so many things to say that lead to very little plot points.
Yeah, I feel like if he had a mustache, he would be twirling it constantly.
Yes.
Absolutely.
I do like his costume, though.
It's very slick. He's everybody's favorite purple sock-wearing Nazi.
Well, are you talking about his Baron Zemo costume or his Citizen Bee costume?
His Baron Zemo costume is super, super purple, and his Citizen Bee is completely opposite.
Yeah, it's so funny, because, like, his Citizen Bee costume is very 90s, I think. But
have the huge shoulder pads.
Yeah, his Baron Zemo costume is, he's like wearing, like Brandon said, he's just wearing a giant purple body sock. It's like somebody, like his grandma knit his costume for him.
You'll find later on if you keep reading, like, so later on they get the swordsman who's Baron von Strucker's son, and he's really long-winded and wordy. And it's like anybody within that, like, Nazi Baron, like, titles, they all talk a ton and then have nothing to say while they're talking.
Yeah. You know, these guys all think they're Doctor Doom. That's their problem.
Absolutely. Though you are actually absolutely right with some of them, later on as you read, they actually kind of realize being a hero is kind of nice. Nobody wants to hurt them. Everybody's kind of okay with them. They get paid. Like, they kind of see definitely the benefits of it.
Yeah, knowing what I know about the future of the Thunderbolts, the title and the team, it's I'm curious to see how that transition is made. Because the team, the purpose of the team, and that kind of thing definitely changes throughout the run. And it was a long run, because it started in 97, and it was still going, like, 10 plus years later. But the team had changed a lot, the lineup had changed, and, like I said, I had not read prior to Secret Invasion, which... By that time, Norman Osborn was the leader of the team, and it was a government agency. It was a government-sponsored team.
I don't want to be spoilery. Yeah, no. There's a few change-ups between... Because Norman lasts for quite a few story arcs, and then Luke Cage takes over.
Right, because I think up until the time he becomes the leader of Hammer... He is the leader of the Thunderbolts. And then after the whole thing with Hammer, was that called Siege? Yeah, Siege. After Siege happens,
yeah.
then Luke Cage takes over the team. Right? Oh, no, the Thunderbolts become the Dark Avengers.
Yeah, they're the Dark Avengers for a while.
Yeah.
Which every... So between Secret Invasion, Dark Avengers, and Siege, the lineup changes between each one of those story arcs.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you get, sometimes you get goofy teams, sometimes you get really awesome teams, and then the goofy teams end up doing a lot more work than the awesome teams do, and, like, the writing is definitely interesting, and it definitely keeps you guessing.
Yeah, because the team changes, the lineup changes so often, and it's not like all of a sudden it'll be, like, five new people. It's like people leave, and then someone else comes in, and it kind of melts together. It really makes interesting dynamics in the team, because some of the people that join the team are straight up like evil people. But anyways, we're jumping a little bit ahead. So in this story, the citizens of the Marvel Universe, as far as they know, these are all brand new heroes. We talked a little bit about Citizen V. What did you guys think about... Well, let me phrase this a different way. So, Jen, who is your favorite character from the lineup, not including Citizen V, since we talked about him a little bit already?
I liked Atlas. He seemed the closest to a genuinely nice guy. Mm-hmm. And his crush on Dallas was just... It was kind of goofy cute. It made him more relatable as a character, I think. And I don't know, Techno was insufferable, I thought. And
yeah, he's like the most annoying person on the team.
Yeah. He's uncomfortably full of himself. Yeah, he's a bit douchey, and then you like think, oh man, okay, so he's totally not going to be like this anymore, and then he just totally continues being a douche.
Yeah, it's
pretty common for that character.
But yeah, and then I feel like we didn't get too much. Mach 1 and Songbird were just kind of into each other, and Meteorite was so tropey. Like, I think there's a scene where she says something about Songbird. Does she even realize what she's doing about Mach 1? And then she's like, and so soon, even for her. What? It's just like this really strange, like, it was a thing in the 90s where female characters always had to comment on the relationships of other female characters for, like, really, I don't know, like, I guess she's the supervisor of the team, so it's her job, but she does it so weirdly in a way that people don't do.
Well, she's a psychiatrist and analyzes the crap out of everybody. And takes it way too far.
Oh god, she... I love how they treat her psychiatry degree like it's a superpower. Like, she can analyze everyone and manipulate them.
I'm just gonna tell you now, if you think it's bad now, it gets worse later.
Oh no.
I actually think she has a really, really long tenure on the team. Like, I think she stays up pretty much till the end, right, Brandon? I think the only time she's not a Thunderbolt is when she's a Dark Avenger. And then she goes back to being a Thunderbolt.
Yeah, she lasts until Dark Avengers. She actually, during Dark Avengers, she's, I guess, cosplaying as Ms. Marvel.
She's the new team's Ms. Marvel, yeah.
Yeah, and she does last for a really long time, but if it makes you feel better, Jen, she gets the bad and worse end of every, like, situation that can ever happen, because she's totally full of herself.
I think that her character becomes much more interesting, and she definitely loses the tendency to analyze people in the way that she does in this. I think she becomes... The portrayal of Meteorite definitely gets better. She becomes a more interesting character to read, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. Definitely becomes probably she's definitely one of my favorites. She's a very interesting and layered character. And she might be the only one who is on the team consistently. So I think she's probably, for me, the face of the Thunderbolts, I guess you could say.
Huh. Okay. She, I don't know. She just seems really goofy 90s to me in this one, but I'd be interested to see more of her and how she changes. But yeah, I mean, I guess I just did the rundown of all of them just because, I didn't feel particularly strongly drawn to any of them.
Mm-hmm.
So it was more like a process of elimination to get to Atlas.
That's fair.
But he's cool.
I mean, it's hard to judge, right?
We
didn't read that many. We didn't read that many characters, and even if you're familiar with like Baron Zemo or Fixer or the Beetle, you know, these are new portrayals of those characters. The characters themselves are working really hard to portray, to play a part, and so we're seeing them as different people. So even if you were familiar, I think it wouldn't be fair to judge them based on their previous, you know, personality. Andy would like us to point out that Meteorite's costume is his favorite from this, this one. I think hers is probably, I was gonna say hers is probably the most 90s, but like thinking about like Atlas's costume, he has that thing on his head, like, that Gambit has, like, it's not, what is it that's on his face?
It's not a mask. It's kind of like a mask, headgear.
But it's like, what is it, right? His hair sticks out of the top, and you can see his face completely. It's like it's a reverse mask or something. It hides everything that masks don't usually hide. You know, Gambit has one of those things.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, I mean,
I'm trying to find a shot.
Fixer just grows a goatee and takes his helmet off.
Well, no, he has hair and a ponytail, and then
then he gets his goatee, his signature goatee.
Yeah.
At one point, somebody makes fun of him for it, and then, like, it causes some sort of, like, one page of, I don't know why you wrote this.
So, I think, you know, like I said, overall in Thunderbolts, I think, Meteorite / Moonstone / Miss Marvel is my favorite overall, like in all of the Thunderbolt stuff I've read. In this one, she's certainly not my favorite. I think, like you, Jen, it would be kind of hard to choose because none of them are like, I don't identify with any of them particularly in a strong way. I think they all have interesting qualities that make them, I never see one person on the page and think, oh my god, I can't believe I have to read more about this character. Techno kind of gives off that vibe, but it's because, like you said, he's insufferable. But I still kind of want to see what he's going to bring to the table and on the page, you know? If I had to pick somebody, probably, see, it's hard for me to separate them from what I know about them going forward and from what they are now. Songbird's probably up there. I like her a lot. She's got interesting powers and, I don't know. I don't know who my favorite would be from this. What about you, well, Brandon?
I think out of this lineup, I'm definitely a fan of Songbird, but that's just because I know what her future is and I know where she develops. Like in this, she's only supposed to be like, I think in her late teens, like, early 20s, I think. And out of everybody on the team, she's actually supposed to be the youngest. And so this, like, she doesn't have, like, a lot of interesting dialogue. She's written very childish, like, in regards to her actions and this and that. And you can see, like, they write in her inexperience with a lot of things. Because her Masters of Evil persona, Screaming Mimi, like, was really not that good. She was a really terrible villain, and she was one of those people that she was a character that got written much better as a hero. It's her and Mach 1 because of how many iterations of his suit he creates, and his name just changes to whatever version of the suit it is. And I think by the time he ends, he's like Mach 7 or something. I always love the running joke of like how many different Mach numbers he ended up with. And it's like, he made a small, you know, the wings look different. I'm Mach 5. And it's like, it was definitely something I was kind of like, okay, so how many numbers are we going to go for before he finally gets bitten out?
Yeah.
But those two actually drive the team pretty far later on in the series. And honestly, before, when you guys were like, hey, you know, you should join us and we want to read this comic, I had to go back and I was like, oh man, were they really written like this? I totally forgot how bad they were written. Because when I was discussing it with, when I was really getting into it and I was discussing it with somebody at a comic book shop, they were like, just try not to think of Mach 1 as being creepy because Songbird's so young. Because he's supposed to be in his late 20s, and he kind of goes, hey, let's hang out. You're really young, let's hang out. And it's like, it gets really creepy. I understand it's the 90s writing, but it was still kind of unnerving after he pointed that out, and I was like, oh, I can't unread this now.
I noticed that Kurt Busiek really likes to call people kiddo, because Mach 1 calls Songbird kiddo multiple times, and I think Atlas calls Jolt kiddo a couple times.
Wait, Mach 1 does that?
I'm pretty sure he calls her kiddo, I think. Oh my God. I could be remembering it. Maybe I'm remembering it wrong. So,
wow. Number one rule, if you call someone kiddo, don't date them.
They definitely grow up in as the comic goes on. But
still, wow. Creepy.
So, what did you think of their fights? And that's, you know, both of you can, either one, like, what did you guys think of, like, how their fights unfolded?
Felt pretty standard. Although, I will say, like, they had a weird lineup of who they were fighting. At first, I think it kind of made sense to put them up against smaller villains, just because they're, like, getting established, so you can't have them, you know, fighting someone really big and then suddenly winning out of nowhere. But, you know, by the end, I'm kind of like, why are we fighting these people? Why do I care? But it was always kind of the same thing, like Atlas gets knocked down, gets back up again, and Techno goes off on his own and is an asshole and endangers the team, and Songbird's not quite sure of herself. Meteorite orders people around, and Baron Zemo gives some kind of snarky remark.
Zemo's definitely the best at quipping with his opponents.
Yes, he's the Spider-Man of the team.
Yeah.
So the one way that the Thunderbolts, the early years, was explained to me, especially when I was getting into it, was, think early 90s Saturday morning adventure cartoon.
That is so true.
Like, that is the one thing I was like, okay, so this is why I like this so much. It's because that's what I grew up on, and that's what I'm like, oh yeah, this is totally the back and forth fighting. And then, like, they fought the Pack Rats, which, you know, it definitely is, it's, there's the small fry and enemies, they're kind of jumping on the scene, and the great part is, if you keep reading it, the Wrecking Crew is this weird group that they always fight. I don't know what it is, but every once in a while, the Thunderbolts will always fight the Wrecking Crew. There's like three or four more times that they fight them outside of this.
Well, I think the Wrecking Crew is one of those teams that's just, like, they don't stray too far out of New York, so they kind of fight all the New York heroes pretty regularly. But I think that they're kind of interesting because they're pretty powerful.
Well, they're blessed by Nordic magic, right?
Yeah, so the power that ended up inside, God, this is, inside Wrecker's magic crowbar.
I love the story behind this.
That was meant for Loki, and it somehow got into the crowbar, and then Wrecker somehow shared it with the other guys on the Wrecking Crew when they were in prison.
Yeah.
And it's so funny because, like, so Wrecker, Bulldozer, and
Thunderball, and Piledriver.
Piledriver. So Wrecker, Piledriver, and Bulldozer are all, like, idiots. But Thunderball is, like, a legitimate doctor. Isn't he? Isn't he, like, a legit doctor?
I don't remember. I just remember it's like, sweet, I get to watch them beat up the Wrecking Crew again.
I'm pretty sure that Thunderball is like an actual, like, smart guy. But somehow he thought it would be a good idea to just hang out with these guys. But yeah, the Wrecking Crew, I think, is a good litmus test for heroes.
Yeah, there's a lot of, like, I don't know if the comics that we'll cover later involves it, but there is a fight with, I think it's a Luke Cage era, and they have Speed Demon, who used to be, he was a villain called the Whizzer, and, he takes the crowbar and beats the crap out of the guy in, like, Mach 1. And it was, I think it's by far my favorite panel I've ever seen involving the Wrecking Crew.
Yeah, I think I know you've talked to me about that scene multiple times.
Because it's best one ever.
So I pulled up like Thunderball's wiki page, and it says he is a genius level physicist, nearly on par with Bruce Banner.
Huh.
But for some reason,
he hangs out with these guys.
So I don't know. But yeah, well, I think the Wrecking Crew's they're Marvel Universe stalwarts, and I'm never really sad to see them.
No, they're a fun group to watch, especially when they like get to kind of cut loose and kind of go crazy. Mm-hmm. Because you explained them to me, I could not believe that was an actual team.
Oh come on, Marvel has Stilt Man.
Well, I was just getting into it when David was explaining the Wrecking Crew to me, and I was really trying hard to believe this.
They're pretty fun. I like them.
The best part about villains like this is that they're written unironically. They're 100% genuine people with Norse power imbued crowbars. And I don't know, there's something about that that's just so charming. Like, I really like the corny villains, like Stilt Man and, there's, like, some robots that Captain America fought. I can't remember the names. But, I don't know. Corny villains are my favorite.
What was that one that you were telling me, Dave? Something Mom. It's, she has, like, an appliance or something. Yeah, that was
That's a DC character, Microwave Mom.
Oh, so many goofy villains.
That's DC. But, yeah.
Wait, what does Microwave Mom do? Does she, like, heat you up Hot Pockets?
I don't... Don't Google Microwave Mom without adding DC to it, because it's some pretty disturbing stuff.
Wait, now I have to Google it?
It just, like, if you look at her on the Wikipedia, like the DC wiki page, just says, history of this character is unknown.
That's amazing. What is her
powers? It doesn't even really say, like, what her power is, but she's, like, shooting beams out of her hands. Oh my god, no, it's Microwave a Bell. I don't know why I called her Microwave Mom, but yeah, there's...
Oh, aliases! Microwave Mom.
Oh, Microwave a Bell. The picture of her, it has her, a thought bubble that says, a little microwave power should make his knife too hot to handle. So I think she just heats things up like a microwave?
Huh.
That's legit.
That's not a euphemism at all.
But yeah, I mean, comic books are chock full of fun characters like the Wrecking Crew and Microwave Mom.
Also, this definitely adds to the charm.
Microwave a Bell.
So, one of the panels I'll kind of point out, because it kind of definitely shows a cracking point, I guess, within the team, is when Atlas gets knocked out, when he gets knocked into the water, and he jumps out and he wants to kill Thunderball. The intensity on his face, if you look at it, like, that's kind of what leads into knowing that there's something wrong. Because I was thumbing through this again, and I forgot exactly how some of the panels I really love, how they're drawn, and some of them I'm like, okay, this is generic 90s.
Some of them have really tiny 90s feet.
Yes.
It's kind of half the fun, right?
Yeah. No pouches, though.
artifact of the times.
But
nobody has any pouches.
Mach 1 has, like, gadgets that kind of hold stuff.
Well, Techno could probably make a pouch with his tech pack.
Probably.
Yeah. His thought-linked tech pack.
Yeah. You know, one thing that I do appreciate about this comic is, you know, what did we read? Like, 8 issues? And we get the reveal early on that they're supervillains, which I think is good because that's, like, the whole part of the conflict in within the team or in the comic overall. But I think that the whatever's going to happen to this group of people is going to be a slow burn, you know? I think they didn't give away too much up front. And knowing the longevity of the Thunderbolts title, you know, we definitely see the start of that here because they don't give away too much. And, you know, that's a positive.
Yeah, one of the things that happened that is kind of noticed later on is Black Widow shows herself.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, she's very, you know, yeah, she's supposed to be, like, skeptical and kind of reads into people, and that was one of the points where I'm like, does she know? Has she figured it out? Like, I'm really, like, it was always kind of, like, interesting turning the next page going, is, like, she gonna say something? Because she wants next to nothing to do with them. And she really doesn't trust them at all, and especially when they're fighting another version of the Masters of Evil. It's, you know, they're like, hey, we should be friends because we're all heroes, and she immediately has nothing to do with them and just disappears.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, whatchamacallit, even at the end where Zemo is talking to Baron von Strucker, he seems to, there's some recognition there.
Yeah, and so the dynamic between Zemo and Strucker is always interesting. Just, they're playing their games around each other. And definitely through the run of the Thunderbolts, it's interesting to watch them kind of interact.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, I think that we're just getting, like, a peek of what's to come. In there'll be more situations where their recognition is going to be even stronger or more of a problem.
Oh, did you guys like that tie-in with Armin Zola?
He's another one of those choice villains, you know? I mean,
yeah.
He has a face on his body. Well, it's a screen, right? And it's his real face.
Yeah, that it's supposed to be like it's kind of like that whole Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Krang thing.
Yes, I love Krang.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's always kind of fun, because you're like, oh, okay, so he's a face in a suit. That's cool, I guess. But, I mean, Armin Zola is not the worst villain. He at least has interesting ideas around him.
Yeah. So, we kind of touched on the art a little bit. What did you guys think of the art, aside from the choice of feet?
I liked a lot of the costume designs. Like Andy Meteorites was my favorite, probably for slightly different reasons, but it was pretty sweet.
Well, I want to know what your reasons were, and so we can try to speculate what Andy's reasons might be.
Well, I mean, honestly, she looked really hot in it, so those are probably the same reasons. But it's just, aside from being, like, egregiously 90s, it looks cool with all the sleek lines and the pointiness, and she looks threatening, which I think is kind of the intention. So, I mean, that's good, right? Like, she looks outer spacey and a bit sci-fi.
Yeah.
I just think that's kind of cool. It's interesting, and she kind of reminds me of Jean Grey as the Phoenix with the little, like, pointy mask.
Huh, that's true. I'd never thought about that.
Yeah, I think the art, we mentioned it already, that it's definitely, like, 90s art, but it's still good. You know, on this podcast, we kind of make fun of this period of comics a little bit. But this is just what, you know, this was how the stuff was done at the time, but everything is well drawn. It's easy to identify the different members of the team, even out of their costumes. There's strong consistency, which I think that, at least for me, when characters are drawn in an inconsistent way, it kind of pulls me out of the experience of reading the comic.
Yeah.
So I think the art was definitely good.
There's actually a pretty big difference between the art between issue 1 and issue 5. It's almost like they realized the traction that was gaining and it like got a lot sharper.
Mm-hmm.
You kind of see a lot more detail, especially like, not to keep using Meteorite as an example, but her costume seems like almost more bold. Like it jumps out of the page a little harder.
Yeah, that's actually true. I'm looking at it again, and there's a lot more line shading as we get further in, too. And it's well done, because I think it's really easy to go heavy-handed on that and make everything super contrasty. But here, it actually makes the colors look really bright. And
if you flip over to page 19, there's actually a really good panel with Atlas that shows a lot more detailing in his costume that I think kind of adds, like, you kind of realize, like, the depth of what they do for him. Because this costume was pretty terrible looking in the first two issues. Like, it was pretty bad.
Yeah, I mean, I think he has the goofiest costume out of the bunch, too.
Absolutely.
Yeah, he has kind of, they all have, like, kind of X-Men-ish features, too. Like, we mentioned Atlas has, like, the Gambit headpiece thing going on. Songbird's hair is just inverse Rogue.
Yeah, yes, it is.
Like, what's going on there?
She actually, she actually has the Storm hair mohawk later.
Yeah. Oh, but God.
She gets a really short haircut later, huh?
Yeah, she has the mohawk, which has, like, it's the white with the pink accent, and then it goes into the short hair, and then suddenly, like, it's, like, two issues later, she has really long hair again.
That's weird.
You just kind of learn to, like, roll with it. Yeah, if you get to notice a lot more about Techno, with his costume as well. Because they just kind of draw, like, giant silverish shapes, and you're kind of like, okay, so it's technology, I don't know what else it's supposed to be. But you kind of get to see a lot more with him, especially with the evolution of his tech pack, because it becomes less of, like, exoskeleton harness, and becomes more of, like, just, it's a part of him.
Mm-hmm. You know, I realized we made a mistake, or I made a mistake when I was doing the intro. I said Peter David was the artist, but he actually was not. It was Mark Bagley for most of it. Peter David, I think, was a co-author with Kurt Busiek. So, sorry about that, listeners. But yeah, it was Mark Bagley who did the art.
Okay.
Just for talking about art. Just wanted to make that correction.
The one person, if you notice, his costume never really changes, is Citizen V.
His mask is awesome. It gets more reflective, though, as you go on. Like, it starts looking like it's cloth in issue 1, and by the time you get to the end, like, there's lines drawn and shading, and it's clear that it's metal.
Well, then, you can still read his... You can still see some facial expressions in it, too, which I think is interesting.
Yeah.
I've always referred to it as the rip-off Rorschach. You can kind of see something in it, but you're like, you didn't get all the cool stuff with the Rorschach effects.
No, he is... So, smash up Rorschach, Ozymandias, and, what's his name? The kind of bad guy who fought in Vietnam and then tried to... rape his teammate.
The comedian.
Add those three together and you get Citizen V in his costume.
Yeah, he's got the megalomania of Ozymandias. The patriotism
yeah.
of comedian.
And Rorschach's mask.
Yeah. That's a very Cool observation, Jen.
And can we, while we're at this, point out that Jolt is just Jubilee in disguise with short hair? Yeah.
She doesn't last very long.
We haven't mentioned Jolt at all. And actually, I was going to ask you, Brandon, because I have never seen her before. So I was going to ask you what happens to Jolt.
She doesn't last for very long. She's she's part of the team for, I think, like 5 or 6 issues. And then just kind of disappears. Like she's kind of, okay, well, I'm going to do my thing now. And yeah, it's... She's like a memorable, non-memorable character. There's a reincarnation of her later. It's not really her, but it's like a version of her called Joystick, which is not much better.
No, it's not.
She was terrible as well. And I don't know what it is. The Thunderbolts always seem to write in one, like, crappy character. And then they just kind of disappear, which is just kind of normal for them. But, yeah, no, she lasts, like, maybe another 4 or 5 issues and then kind of disappears and then comes back. And she's on the team for a little bit.
Interesting.
She's not that exciting.
She seems kind of forgettable.
Yeah.
Yeah, she definitely is. Yeah, I mean, later on, people do... It's not even that much later on. People actually do find out who they are. And they just kind of go, we promise not to be bad guys. And people go, okay, that works for us, I guess.
Oh, really? That's actually yeah. really... I like that development. That's really cool.
Yeah, there's... like I've said, you know, like I said before, there's so much variance and there's so much changes and there's so many things that, like, just dynamically flow for this team that it just always keeps it interesting. Especially, like, you know, later on, they get, there's, within the team, they, at 2 different periods, they get 2 different versions of Venom. I mentioned later on, you know, there's an A team and a B team, and one of them, the B team, has Mr. Hyde and, like, Boomerang, and, they end up with Satana, and, like, there's so many characters that you're like, oh my god, I totally forgot about them.
Actually, one of my favorites towards the end is one of the, when Satana's on the team, and they have, like, their King Arthur adventure. That's probably one of my favorites.
They go through time, that's right, they go through
time. Seriously, that sounds, like, kind of wacky, Jen, but their King Arthur adventure is actually really good, but it's really late in the run.
It's Centurious, like...
Oh, yeah,
they get a lot of cool characters. This is like, you could pick any era and pretty much just kind of be like, okay, this is a pretty sweet team. I think
I did like Juggernaut on the team too. That was really cool.
Yeah, Kane Marco is such a cool character when he's the Thunderbolts Juggernaut, because they don't treat him like anything more than what he is, and he just kind of like flows with the team really well.
Yeah, I think he finds a good place.
Yeah, that's right before Fear itself.
Yeah. Well, we're kind of straying off a little bit, so and we're hitting about the hour mark now. So why don't we rate this one and then wrap up? So Brandon, I don't know if you're familiar with the way we do ratings. We just kind of we rate comics on a 1 to 5 scale, or I guess 0 to 5 scale, and you can award a half point. So like a totally average comic would be a 2.5.
Okay.
How about Jen, you go first.
I'm going to give this a 3. I think that it laid the groundwork really well for this, and I'm actually interested in seeing what happens to this team, especially since you guys mentioned that it's revealed that they are exposed as bad guys and people just don't care, which I think is an excellent way to handle that. This is tough because I understand it's personal bias and it's like totally subjective, but I'm feeling so done with 90s and I have for maybe the past year. So that brings down this comic for me. I just, the writing of 90s comics is not something I've like had as much fun with lately. And I know, was it 3-4 years ago when we started doing this? Like, I thought it was really fun, and I guess it just wore down over time, but that's kind of the only thing bringing this down. I thought that the reveal, as someone who had no background on this whatsoever, was really well done. I was genuinely surprised when it turned out they were villains. I didn't expect that. And, you know, I've read enough comics now that it's actually kind of rare that things surprise me, especially with Cape comics. So that was, you know, really impressive to me. But the writing, the prose, the dialogue bubbles, the adverbs kind of brought it down for me. So I'm going to give it a 3.
Yeah, there was definitely a lot of narration. And I'd like to point out, I think we're approaching 6 years now, Jen.
Oh my god, wow. Okay.
We started in 2010. I think we started in 2010.
That sounds about right.
Yeah. Oh my god. So much of my life's spent on this. how about, and okay, you go next, Brandon, since you're our guest. And I'm hosting, so I get to decide how things go. So you, okay, your turn.
Well, I think you're... In regards to this version,
We try to, when we rate it, we're trying to rate just what we read. So just this trade.
Well, I was going to say, because of the fact that I started so late, and then, because, you know, Jen's coming into this fresh, and I already kind of know everything, but in regards to the writing and how everything was on this, if this was the first comic I was reading of the Thunderbolts, I definitely would probably go about 3.5, because I'm not a huge fan of the 90s writing. The action, the reveal, kind of like that hook definitely would have kept me going, but it's so wordy. I totally forgot exactly how wordy this comic is, and it's a lot of dialogue to digest.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Yeah, overall 3.5.
That's still pretty good. That's still pretty good. I mean, like I said, 2.5 is the average, so it's definitely an above average comic. I'm going to agree with Brandon and also give it a 3.5. You know, like both of you said, it definitely feels like a product of its time, but I think it's different enough. The premise is different enough to make it still interesting. I don't know if this would be where I would recommend somebody to start with the Thunderbolts, but I think if you did just decide to start at the beginning, this would be a perfectly fine place to start. You know, the art is clean, very good, and easy to follow. The action's done well. So yeah, like I said, 3.5. It's a pretty good comic. Definitely. If you think it's interesting, the premise is interesting, check it out. Alright, so I think we're gonna skip quotes again. Alright, listeners, so next week, we're going to read, we're gonna jump ahead a bit in the Thunderbolts storyline to, the point where Warren Ellis takes over writing and Mike Diodato takes over the artwork. So volume 1 is called Faith in Monsters. We'll post a link to the Amazon page on our website, which is www.welcometocomics.com. Like I said, we're going to skip trivia for tonight, so check out our website for more information about next episode and episodes coming up after that. Thanks very much for listening. Goodbye.
Goodbye.